Join us this week as we descend into the darker side of human nature and uncover the shadows that dwell in the unknown. From chilling true crime and gruesome murders to spine-tingling paranormal encounters that defy explanation, we're peeling back the curtain on things that go bump in the night. So grab a flashlight and maybe a blanket, because you're listening to The Guilty and the Ghostly.
To the camera and say hi.
Are you trying to make me famous?
No, but we can hear everything you guys are saying in there.
Actually.
Yeah, and we've been recording for a while.
Do you want to say hi?
No. Should I do it?
Yeah?
Yeah, just wave your hand. No, I'm going to give him a double chin. Do it. Put your face right there in the camera.
Y'all just keep it down a little bit, please. Love you. Well, that was our children saying hi.
Yep.
We were trying to record, and we could hear everything they were saying in the dining room.
Welcome back.
Welcome back. Hope you all enjoyed the holidays. We had a good one. Spent time with family. Gave some gifts.
Yeah. Had fun. I'm still tired.
I know. I feel bad. So the guys are working today. I didn't have to go in, but they're working. And I'm just like, thank God I don't have to be there. Need some days off.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing about this time of year is, I mean, I enjoy it. I enjoy spending time with family. I love gift giving. Like, that's one of my love languages. I love to give gifts. But I get so overstimulated with all the decorations and then the aftermath of opening presents, because our living room is full of boxes still because our dumpster is completely full. And of course, trash pickup's messed up because Christmas Day fell on trash pickup day.
Mm-hmm.
So there's empty boxes everywhere. We live in Texas. It's 80 degrees right now. It was. It's actually a little bit cooler today.
But not there's much.
Dead leaves everywhere. So we can't even burn the boxes if we wanted to. So,
yeah. I got to clean up the yard.
Yeah, we got to clean up the yard. We have to clean up all the leaves before we can burn anything. So it's just a lot. I'm ready for calmness. Whenever that may come, 18 years later.
What's that?
But we, like I said, we had a good Christmas. Josh got me some goodies for our wall. I don't know if you'll be able to see it in the camera, which is another gift that Josh got me. He got me a camera so we can record and hopefully make this a little bit better and easier for you guys.
Yep. Hopefully everything works on our end as well.
Yeah. We're experimenting. We'll see how it goes. And of course, the episode we have today is super long, so it always falls like that. I do have some like true crime news that's going around here. Have you seen the guy that's been missing in I think Jacksonville or Russ County right now? Like, it's active?
No.
So there's a guy, let me pull it up. I believe his name's like James David Blount. Let me look it up. I've been sharing it on our page.
Maybe I have seen that. That name sounds familiar. I just don't think I looked at it.
Because you don't look at what I post.
I'm part of the problem.
He yells at me because I don't look at the stuff that he sends me, but he don't ever look at my stuff either.
I look at it. Briefly.
Briefly.
But at least I look.
I glance for a second.
After I tell you.
Yeah, pretty much. Okay, this one has some good information. Okay. So this is a case update since he's went missing. So I'm kind of starting a little bit farther back, not just the day he's missing, because like I said, there is some kind of shady stuff going on, which seems to be a common occurrence around here with police departments. This is case update, suspicious circumstances surround David Blount's disappearance, police treating case as critical. As the search for James David Blunt enters its fourth week. New details highlight just how concerning this case has become. Here's the latest confirmed information as of late December 2025. Timeline and suspicious activity. Witnesses report that on Tuesday, December 2nd, David was seen leaving his home in a vehicle with his ex-girlfriend and her daughter. Red flag, the woman reportedly returned to the residence later that night without David. The aftermath, following his disappearance, David's home was reportedly burglarized. We are seeing many rumors circulating online. Here are some of the facts regarding the physical evidence. Because that's another thing, is they're like, they haven't been taking this seriously. They have not been looking for this missing man like they should be. They kind of blew it off, and now it's getting kind of a lot of attention for it. And so now I feel like they're going back and trying to cover their tracks.
Mm-hmm.
It says the truck was found on December 6th on Highway 84 West near the Neches River Bridge. It had been parked there since December 2nd. So that's a long time to be parked there and nothing. Mm. His wallet, his phone were both found at his home, not in the truck, and this made digital tracking nearly impossible. There was a kayak with DNA. While community members have pointed out that a kayak and photos of the truck, officials have not confirmed rumors regarding missing DNA on the vehicle or the kayak. The focus remains on physical searches of the river to see if he entered the water. They did have a search on December 26. Specialized teams from Heal Corp are actively using cadaver dogs and divers to search for the through the Neches River and surrounding area. Foul play, authorities have not ruled out foul play. There is a $25,000 reward. Let's see here. Someone knows something, say something. And it wasn't just him. His dog was with him and vanished at the same time. So for 3 weeks, him and his dog have just been missing. The woman that he was with has returned, but they're like, oh, I don't know where he went. He went missing from Rust, Texas on December 1st, 2025. Witnesses saw David arguing with his ex-girlfriend and her daughter in front of his home. At about 2 to 3 o'clock, a witness watched David and the ex-girlfriend and her daughter get into a vehicle and drive down Highway 84. Later that night, the two women were seen returning to David's house without David, and he has not been seen since. His truck was found abandoned 5 days later. His phone, wallet, keys were all found inside his home. So how did his truck get there, and how did his keys get back to the house?
That is a good question.
This also indicates that he did not plan on leaving long if he left his wallet and his phone and everything else. Following his disappearance, his home was broken into and items were stolen, including a lawnmower. The dog's missing.
Sometimes you gotta mow the grass.
I guess so. There's a miniature pincher named Lady who is also missing. Often finding the pet leads to finding the person. Please keep an eye out for the dog or him. It is an active investigation. How does a man vanish from a vehicle while the other passengers returned safely? It looks like he drove a red truck, which I will post the missing person's poster. That way you can have all the information. He looks like a red Chevy truck. You're better with.
Oh, yeah, that's going to be like a 99 to 04 or 03. I think 02 was last year, actually. 99 to 02 model.
Yep.
Chevy. Extended cab. I can't tell if it's a three-quarter ton or a half ton.
Yeah, so we'll post that information. I know a lot of local people listen. Be on the lookout. Let's at least get some answers.
Yeah.
It's just a lot of weird circumstances. And then there was, I seen another one again. I don't know if it's rumors or true or fact or whatever, but it looked like there was blood on the kayak, but they sent the kayak back home and they released the truck back to the family too. And so the truck was just parked out there. And as far as they know, no evidence had been collected from the truck. They literally just said, yep, it's abandoned, and let them take it back home. So even if there was any evidence in the truck, it's all contaminated now because they released it back to the family.
That's interesting that they did that instead of doing any kind of work.
Investigation, I mean, it's just strange.
Especially in a missing persons case, you'd think that would be ground zero.
Yeah, start right there. And another thing is the chief of police has since been suspended without pay. They said it has nothing to do with the case. It was personal matters. But it's kind of funny how he's been suspended while this is going on, and it looks like the ball was dropped completely. So it just kind of makes you wonder.
And the problem is it seems like a lot of the small towns like this around here have those kind of guys operating their
shady.
And it's weird. Like, we just had one here a couple of years ago that no longer has a police force at all.
Yeah.
And that was
Did you ever have to pay that ticket?
I don't remember. Yeah, I think I did.
Yeah, I think you did. Then it got closed down. Like,
it was after that. like a month after.
Yeah.
Is when they shut down.
Yeah, Josh got a ticket, and it's been a few years, so I guess we paid it. You don't have a warrant for your arrest, so I guess we're good.
That's been at least 8 years ago, probably.
Yeah, and then they, unbeknownst to anybody, I guess, the entire police department was under investigation for shady dealings. And
not just shady dealings, but one of the guys that was on the force had criminal records.
Yeah,
like extensive.
A couple of them did, and they were hiring from down like in Houston and bringing them up here or something, and it was all kinds of shady stuff. We may have to look into that and do a bonus episode. One. I don't know if it'd be long enough. But, yeah, that's kind of what's going on around here. That's all I got. I don't have anything else.
Yeah.
I know we did mention we were going to do a kid-friendly episode for Christmas Eve. We did not do it. We got busy with the kids. We were enjoying our time with them. It just didn't work out. So if you're expecting this to be a kid-friendly episode, it is not.
Nor
I do not.
Close.
No, it is heart-wrenching. Tori was going to try to come and record, but she couldn't get here till later. And with editing and everything, I was like, no, we've got to record before that. So I was kind of giving her a brief summary of it. And I came in here to do it so Josh couldn't hear, because there's some kind of crazy things that I wanted him to be surprised. And she was like, oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And I only know a little bit of what's to come.
Yeah.
Just like a very brief description is all you basically told me. And for my own purposes, didn't look any of it up.
Yeah.
Just because I want you guys to get the full reaction.
Genuine reaction.
Yeah.
So I guess with that, we can jump in.
All right.
So today we are going to be talking about Jessica Chambers.
Okay.
This is a wild story. And if you do listen to true crime, most likely you've already heard this story. But I have found some updates as early as this month to this case kind of in a broad scale. And that'll make sense once I get into the story. I didn't know that once I finished my research that I was doing, because I did this off of a documentary. It's a really good documentary. I definitely recommend it. It's called Jessica Chambers, an ID Murder Mystery. So after I watched the documentary, I went and Googled to see if there had been any updates, and my mind was completely blown. So today's case takes place in Cortland, Mississippi in 2014. It's a small town known for its small town feel, friendly community. It's in Panola County, which is a blue-collar community with a history tied to railroad and cotton industry. It's a town where everyone literally knows everyone. I did try to find the population for 2014, but I couldn't really find any direct answer. Mm-hmm. It does say that in 2025, the estimated population is 478 people. So very small.
Yeah.
It does have, this was kind of cool, it has a 170-year-old cemetery with Confederate soldiers and then, like, the Greek Revival monuments, like the Greek Colosseums, I guess you would call them, or grave things. It was really cool. I looked at pictures and it was really neat. So, on December 6th, 2014, at about 8 o'clock, there were two men driving down a back road called Heron Road. They were just kind of, I guess, just cruising. You know how they do. In the middle of nowhere when there's nothing else to do, you just...
Oh, yeah. We grew up doing the same thing.
Drive back roads.
Yep.
It was completely dark out. The only light was their headlights and the moon, and just ahead of them, they could see what they thought was a fire. As they get closer, they're trying to figure out what's going on, and as they get closer, they realize it's actually a car on fire in the middle of the woods. Well, with it being in the middle of the woods, they were kind of worried that it would spread and cause a huge fire, so they called 911. Well, the volunteer fire department just so happened to be running a call really close by. It was like a small fire, another fire call, but it had nothing to do with this. It just so happened to be at the same time. So they were able to get to the scene within 2 minutes. So very quick answer time. That's not the word I'm looking for.
Response time.
Response time. Answer time. So they pull up. And they're just kind of assessing the scene. There's no other vehicle there. They don't see anybody inside the vehicle. So they're like, okay, it's just a vehicle on fire in the woods. Weird, but okay. So they start getting ready to put it out. And that is, as they're starting to put it out, they start seeing something moving in the distance. And they're like, what the hell is that? And there's this figure walking towards them out of the woods. They would later describe this figure looking almost as like a zombie or almost like a monster emerging from the woods. As the figure got closer, the arm started reaching out, and the figure in a very raspy voice would just start saying, help me, help me. As they got closer, they realized the body was completely black, covered in burns. That her hair was burnt off. They said that she was so severely burned that it basically looked like her lips and her face were melting off of her body. Once they realize this, you know, they also see that she's basically naked. I think she only had underwear on. So one of the volunteer fire departments runs, grabs a blanket, covers her, and as soon as he covers her with the blanket, she collapses, just hits the ground. And they're trying to figure out, you know, who is this? So they begin asking her, like, what's your name? Who are you? And she goes to answer, but she's so badly burnt that she can't even say her own name correctly. So she ends up saying Jessica Chambers. But again, this is a small town, so they know Jessica Chambers is who this is, and they actually know this girl. So it's bad enough to see a stranger like this, but to actually somebody that you know and see on a daily basis to be in this condition, mm-hmm. It caused a lot of the first responders to that call to have PTSD and nightmares, and it really messed them up. Really bad.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
They asked her multiple times, and her skin was beginning to tighten up from her burns, and she was struggling to breathe. And of course, like I said, she finally was able to muster out Jessica Chambers. While some of the first responders were trying to tend to Jessica, the others started to try and put out the fire, because this fire was basically completely engulfing that car. Like, there was nothing left of that car once they put it out. There was no evidence of a wreck. There were no other cars. They came to the conclusion very quickly that someone set the car and Jessica on fire intentionally. Realizing this, they began asking Jessica, "Who did this to you?" Jessica was still having a lot of trouble talking. She was kind of in and out of consciousness. They're trying to make her as comfortable as possible, but they're trying to figure out, like, who did this to you? And she was having so much trouble talking because not only was she burned that badly on the outside of her body, but because whoever did this, when they poured the flammable substance over her, it ended up in her mouth and nose, and the fumes went into her mouth and nose. So when they lit her on fire, it literally burned the inside of her body as well.
Wow.
She is finally able to say something along the lines that they thought were either Eric or Derek. They couldn't make out what it, but it sounded like that, like an irk sound. Once she says that, she basically goes unconscious. Like, she's no longer, she's still alive, but her body is just in complete shock and shutting down at this point. So they end up flying her to Memphis Regional 1 Hospital, where they have basically an amazing burn center there. So that was like the best place they could send her. While they have her on the way to the hospital to be treated, someone has the responsibility of finding her parents to let them know that their baby was not only burned beyond recognition, but somebody did this on purpose. I could not imagine having that job. The closest thing that I can think of that we have had to deal with that is when we lost Steven. Mm-hmm. And we didn't even have to feel that firsthand. Our really good friend did. It was her husband, And she said that, I mean, she was in complete shock, and I couldn't imagine having to be the one to deliver the news that your loved one's no longer there.
No, me either.
Her parents were divorced, so they did go to her father's house first. Her father's name was Ben, and he was the first one that they told. It was him and his wife, Debbie. And what's great about this family is even though they were no longer together, they co-parented really well. Like, they were all really good friends. They kind of co-parented their own kids. Like, all the siblings were raised together. They were a close family. So Debbie, she ends up jumping in the car and driving down to Lisa's house. And Lisa is Jessica's mother. She pulls up to Lisa's house, and she immediately gets out and just starts screaming, they set Jessica on fire. And Lisa's like, I just talked to her like an hour or two ago. Like, what do you mean? What do you mean they set her on fire? So they have no idea what's going on. They don't know if Jessica's made it. They don't know if she hasn't. They just know they have to get to the hospital immediately, and somebody set Jessica on fire. So who was Jessica Chambers? Jessica Lane Chambers was born on February 2nd, 1995, to Lisa and Ben. When Jessica turns 3 years old, her parents would separate but remain close. And Jessica had 5 siblings, and they basically all doted on Jessica. Like, they were all a really close-knit family. Her mom would describe her as a bright, bubbly child that always wanted to do whatever the older kids did, and she would do it. She wouldn't let her size or being a girl or anything, like, stop her from doing what she wanted to do.
We have one of those.
We do. Actually, she said hi just a few minutes ago. Yeah. Our wild child.
Yeah.
She said she could walk into a room and just basically completely own it. It wasn't even, you know, she lit up a room. No, she walked in that room and she owned it.
Get it, girl.
Get it, girl. She was very athletic. She played softball growing up. And then in high school, she would actually get into cheerleading. And if I remember right, I think she actually kind of enjoyed cheerleading even more than softball, and kind of gave up softball a little bit because cheerleading was so
demanding.
Demanding, yeah. And it was hard to balance the two. She still loved them both, but she really excelled at cheerleading. She always had a smile on her face, even when things weren't quite what they seemed behind closed doors. Her father, Ben, when she was younger, had gotten into a little bit of trouble. He was actually arrested for manufacturing meth. While serving his time, he became a mechanic for the sheriff's department. He did such a good job that while he was there and he was released, the sheriff's office would actually hire him as a full-time mechanic once he was released from prison. So I thought that was kind of cool and really changed his life around and did good. In 2012, a tragedy would hit the family, and Jessica's brother, Alan, who she was very close with, would be killed in a car accident at the age of 28. So not only now that they're going through this with Jessica, they've already lost a child to a car accident.
Mm-hmm.
This deeply affected the family, especially Jessica. Not knowing how to cope with the loss, Jessica began hanging out with a rougher crowd and making some questionable decisions. And Jessica would end up graduating high school in 2013 and began working at Goodies while she decided what her next steps in life would be. And I mean, I say she kind of made questionable decisions. What teenage girl, boy, it doesn't matter. I mean, you're trying to figure out who you are. So yeah, you may go smoke a little weed or go do some drinking. And, mm-hmm. you know, everybody kind of goes through that. Just kind of.
We've all kind of had our little spot where we just kind of did some crazy things.
Crazy stuff, yeah.
Definitely made questionable decisions.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of just the way that we learn.
Yeah, exactly.
Because unfortunately, you can tell your kids not to do something.
They're going to do it.
And over and over. But a lot of the time, you have to learn from your own accord.
Yeah. And with us, we've always tried to balance that with our kids of letting them learn from their mistakes and trying to guide them. But like you said, you can tell them not to 100 times, yeah. But they're going to do it if they want.
Yeah. So. And a lot of the time, if you do tell them not to do it, they're going to do it.
And my thought always is, I would rather them be open with me and I know they're going to do something and I can at least make sure they do whatever it is safely.
Yeah.
Than me just not letting them make their own mistakes and live their lives and just hide it from me. Because then you don't know what's going on with your child.
Yeah.
So it's hard. Parenting is rough.
It is.
Well, like I said, she went to work at Goodies, which is a clothing store, and her coworkers absolutely adored her. They said she was great. She always had a great personality. She worked hard. She did really good. Jessica had mentioned maybe wanting to become a nurse, maybe a teacher, but she also had mentioned wanting to become a writer. So there was actually a author that came to her church to give a speech. Her name was Linda Oliver. And after she gave the speech at church, Jessica went up to the author and told her that she actually had something that she wanted to write and that she had a story that she wanted to tell. And Linda would actually tell her, next time I'm here, let's get together and let's see what we can do. And Jessica seemed like she was actually kind of figuring out what she wanted to do. She was finding her way. She was doing better, whatever that means. I mean, she had a job. She was kind of coming up with a plan. It seemed like she was really finding her footing after losing her brother and going through kind of a rough patch. I even seen in one interview with her dad, it was heartbreaking. Her dad said, you know, I remember just a few weeks before she was killed, because she does end up passing away. She was getting in the car and he said that she just kind of stopped and said, I'm doing good, ain't I, Daddy? And he said, yeah, you're doing really good. And then a few weeks later, she's gone.
That's very sad.
Very sad. So back to Jessica and that night. 93% of Jessica's body was covered with second and third degree burns. 93%.
That's insane.
The only places that were not burned were the bottoms of her feet and a lower part of her back, which we'll get to that later on why. Don't let me forget.
All right.
They believe that she was on. She was in the fire for 3 to 5 minutes before she was able to get out of it.
Wow.
The doctors told Lisa, her mom, that at this point there was basically nothing that they could do. They could basically just try to keep her as comfortable as possible and wait it out to see what happens, but it did not look good. Lisa was sitting in the room with Jessica. This hurts my mom heart. She was sitting in the room with Jessica and told her that it was okay. She didn't want her to lie there in pain and that Jessica could let go if she needed to and that everyone would be okay. On December 7th, 2014, 19-year-old Jessica Chambers succumbed to her injuries, and Lisa knew in her heart that Jessica held on just long enough so that everybody could make it to the hospital and say their goodbyes. Could not. This case then would turn into a homicide investigation. This, of course, rattled the entire community. Who could have done this to one of their own? A girl who was loved by everyone and so full of life. How could another human being light a person on fire?
Yeah, seriously, that's a different kind of evil.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to jump ahead, but and they kind of talk about that once they kind of figure out who the suspect is. They often question, did he know that she was still alive and was just trying to get rid of evidence? Or did he think he killed her and then lit her on fire to get rid of evidence? I'm not spoiling, spoiler alert, not spoiling anything still, but did he know? Did he know that she was still alive? They don't know. Back at the crime scene, investigators get to work. They found Jessica's cell phone on the ground outside of the car. It had gotten so hot, and of course, it had gotten so hot that it practically melted from the heat. And then, of course, when they were putting the fire out, water. So they were worried, can we even get any evidence off of this phone because it's been so badly damaged?
Uh-huh.
They also found a piece of Jessica's bra. It was like a strap or scrap piece, like just a little piece of her bra. and they took the car in as evidence as well. It was beginning to look more and more like a sexual assault had occurred. Due to the state of Jessica's body from the fire, they were unable to get any evidence off of her body. So they could not do like a rape kit or anything like that. They just could not get anything because she was so badly burned. The sheriff's department immediately brought in the FBI and the Mississippi and the Mississippi Bureau of Investigations for assistance. They began looking at the car and photographs of Jessica from when she first came in, and that they noticed a splash pattern across her body that would have been caused by an accelerant. They tested the scraps of Jessica's bra and determined that it was gasoline that was used as the accelerant. They began looking closer at what seemed to be a good lead. As I said earlier, the volunteer fire department would say that they thought they heard Jessica say Eric or Derek when they asked her, "Who did this to you?" The Mississippi Bureau of Investigation started with pulling every single Eric and Derek in and around Panola County and started doing their research. They got their addresses, their phone numbers, any information they could get on them, they pulled it. As they are working through the list of names, another piece of evidence is found. Jessica's keys to her car were found about a quarter of a mile away by someone named Jerry King. He claimed that he was pushing his child in a stroller and he spotted something shiny in the ditch, so he picked it up. When he got back home, he realized that it had a tag on it that said Ben's Body Shop, and he associated that with Jessica because of her dad, and so he called the cops and was like, "Hey, I found these keys." So, and I think I talk about it a little bit later, this was kind of shady. So, this guy is supposedly walking down the road, find the keys in the ditch, he hands them to his daughter to play with. On the way, who picks something random up off the side of the road and lets their baby play with it? Like, that's a little weird.
Mm-hmm.
But then, instead of the just coming to grab the keys and then taking them to be tested or whatever, they come, they make him show them where he found it, they lay it back on the ground, estimated where it was at, took pictures, and then sent it off. I don't see how that would benefit anymore. I mean, maybe take a picture of the area where he found them, but why are you bringing the keys back to the area again, laying them down again and taking a picture? That's just kind of weird. I don't know what the benefit in that would be.
I'm not sure.
I would figure that would give more room for contamination doing it that way.
Possibly. But I can see how they would want that for setting up the crime scene, I guess, and
maybe
and making it as accurate as possible.
Yeah, it's just strange, very strange. So just put a pin in that. We'll talk about it a little bit more later, too. So they send them off for DNA testing, and while they're waiting for that, the police continue to try to put together a timeline of what Jessica did that day. Lisa was able to tell them that Jessica had gone out that morning, and she was hanging out with her friend Keisha. And then came home around 2, took a little nap in the recliner until she got a call at 4:25. That's a good nap. That's a good ass nap. 2 to 4:25. I could use one of those naps.
I could use one right now.
Well, Jessica answers the phone. She gets off. She tells the mom, "Hey, I'm going to go to the local store," which was called M&M's Quick Stop. This was basically like the local hangout spot. So almost like where we grew up, the store. There's literally nothing else. So everybody just goes to the store to hang out, meet up till they go to the next location or whatever. It's like kind of the hub of the town.
Depending on the time of year.
Yeah.
In the summertime, it was the Dairy Suite.
Yeah, yeah. But she told her mom, "I'll be back in a little bit," and then she leaves. At 6:48, Lisa got a call from Jessica, and Lisa said it was a little strange because Jessica was known to listen to music. Like, if she was in the car, there was music going, and you could always hear it in the background. And she thought it was kind of strange that it was really quiet, but she was like, well, maybe she's with somebody. She didn't really think much of it, but there was no music. But Jessica was basically just calling her, and she said, hey, I'm going to be out for a little bit longer, but I am coming home because I need to get my room clean. She's like, okay, love you. Talk to you later. They hang up. So that is at, what did I say, 6:48. The investigators then go to the M&M store, and the clerk was able to confirm that Jessica was there the night of her murder. She went to that store frequently, so the clerk actually knew Jessica pretty well. The clerk even told the police officers that they had video surveillance of her, which I've got a video of her going to the gas station. Let me play it for you so you can press play. And you can, I mean, she just pulls up, and if I remember right, she puts like $5 in her gas tank, which is pretty normal for a teenage girl. You put just enough gas in there to get from point A to point B. She goes in there, and then she makes a phone call while she's in there. She's not dressed in anything fancy. She was like wearing camo pajama pants or something like that, and just like a t-shirt. So she wasn't dressed up or anything, just normal, casual, comfy clothes. So they at least were able to place Jessica there at the M&M store. It was determined that Jessica pulled into the gas station just after 5:20. She pumps a little bit of gas and then goes inside and talks to the clerk. She makes a quick phone call and then she drives away. Police then speak with Keisha Meyer, Jessica's best friend that she had been with earlier that day. The friends were hanging out, driving around that day, and they picked up a guy named Quentin. They had just kind of been riding around, hanging out, smoking some weed, just normal teenage stuff. She even mentioned that they went down Heron Road that day, where Jessica would later be found. They then dropped Quentin off. Quentin Tellis was a local that lived in Cortland with his mother. Their house was actually, like, basically right across the street from the M&M Quick Stop. He had a little bit of a record for burglary, but he always seemed to be released from prison early. For one reason or another, he always got released early after he would be convicted of something. Quentin and Jessica had only known each other for about 2 weeks before Jessica was murdered, and so the police went and picked Quentin up and brought him in to be interviewed. He did it voluntarily. He seemed like he wanted to help. He was answering all their questions. His story matched Keisha's story, and he said the same thing. The three of them drove around, smoked some weed, and then they dropped him off. He, again, seemed very cooperative with the police. He said that they dropped him off at about 11 a.m., and that was the last time that he seen Jessica that day. It was at 11 o'clock. They asked Quentin if he knew anyone by the name of Eric or Derek that was connected to Jessica. He tells them of a guy named Derek Holmes. He had been acting strangely towards Jessica. So they go look up this Derek Holmes. They find out that he has a record for exploitation of a minor. So now they have the name Derek, which, remember, they thought she said Eric or Derek.
Mm-hmm.
He was on the sex offender list. And he seemed to be interested in Jessica. Like, he always would go into the store. There was some accounts where, like, she would be in the store and he would go in there and, like, try to convince her to go on a date with him. And it basically would harass her every time she would go in there. And she'd be like, no, no, no. So they went and picked up Derek and they began questioning him. They asked for his alibi for that night that Jessica was killed. What alibi would you give if you were looked at for a crime? What alibi would you give?
I mean, oh, am I guilty? What's the scenario here?
Yeah.
I don't know what I would say if I was trying to get away with something like that, unless
it's just wild. Okay.
I mean, I don't know what you would do in that situation.
Well, are you ready to hear his alibi?
Oh, I can only imagine.
He told detectives that he was at home rubbing his mother's feet.
Okay.
The detective even kind of laughed and was like, well, how how can we be sure that you were at home rubbing your mother's feet? Like, that sounds like the most ridiculous alibi ever. That's like somebody asking you to go do something. It's like, oh, I can't. I've got to wash my hair tonight.
I mean, that's honestly, it's so ridiculous that it's almost believable. Because okay. Why would you lie about something like that?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, to me.
So okay.
I'm assuming that he thought that that would be something that someone wouldn't question, maybe.
Well, the investigators went and they wanted to confirm his alibi. So they go to his mom, and she, sure enough, he was there that night rubbing his feet. She's a diabetic and has a lot of issues, and it wasn't just his mom validating his story. There were actually neighbors hanging out in the yard that night, and they said, no, he actually went in and rubbed his mom's feet. Like, he never left the house. He mm-hmm. legitimately was there all night.
You know, when I was little, I would do that for my dad. So I guess maybe that's why it doesn't seem so out of pocket to me.
Because your dad was diabetic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he would have me do that often.
Yeah. So his alibi checked out. It wasn't Derek Holmes. The detectives continued down the list of Eric and Derek's, and they end up looking into over 468 people by those names in Panola County and surrounding areas. They went through their alibis. They were checking out basically any lead that they could find. While their list of names were all running into dead ends, they were able to pull information from Jessica's badly damaged phone. So they were able to get the information off of it somehow. They were able to see all of Jessica's calls and text messages. There was no sign of a Eric or Derek on her phone. Nothing. And that was a huge surprise to investigators. Like, they just knew they were going to find an Eric or Derek in her phone. There was, however, a phone number that had not been saved as a contact yet. It was just the phone number. It had no name linked to it. And the text messages from this person were, the longer they were talking, the more and more, like, sexually explicit the messages were on their part. Not Jessica's. Jessica was basically turning it down and being like, no, whatever. But their side was very sexually explicit over and over and over again. There was even one where the person had texted her and said, I'm horny. And Jessica kind of blew it off and said something like, oh, Lordy, like, geez, you know. And they responded, what? And she said, you're so crazy. They said, well, can I have some? And she says, I'm tired. I've been working. Gotta lay down. They just said, K. And then she said, you're wild. So, I mean, you can tell she's not interested. Like, she doesn't want anything to do with that. Basically playing nice, just mm-hmm. trying to keep, I don't know. This number was trying to initiate sex from the 3rd up to the night that she was killed. They also realized that this was the same number that Jessica called while she was at the gas station on that surveillance camera.
That's interesting.
So they look up the number, and they find out that that number belongs to Quentin Tellis, the guy that said he didn't see her after 11.
Mm-hmm.
Since Quentin never mentioned to the detectives when he was questioned that he was interested in Jessica, that of course made him very suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
So this time they sent a new set of detectives to talk to Quentin again. And he spoke to them voluntarily. Again, he seemed to be cooperative. However, this time Quentin says that he and Jessica, they did have sex before, and points to the field behind his mom's house and says it happened over there in Jessica's car. So they were basically interviewing him outside his house. And behind his mom's house, there's like this great big field and it has a shed. So he pointed at that shed and was like, we had sex over there in her car. While he is telling detectives about this, about them having sex, and he even mentioned something about having to lean the seat way back. Well, when they brought Jessica's car in for evidence, they noticed that the seat of the car was put way back because she was a very small, petite girl. There's no reason for her seat to be that far back for any reason if she was the one in it. He did tell detectives that they didn't have sex the night that she died, though. That occurred about a week before. They ask Quentin how he gets around, and Quentin leads them to that shed and shows them a dirt bike that he uses. And he also showed them a 5-gallon gas container with gas in it. And if you remember, gas was the accelerant used to set Jessica's car on fire.
Mm-hmm. Very true. But a lot of people have a 5-gallon can of gas.
Very circumstantial at this point. Yeah, very circumstantial. Quentin says again that he did not see Jessica after being dropped off at 11 that morning. The detectives then ask Quentin where he was that night of her murder. And he's like, oh, I was in Batesville, which is about 10 minutes away from where they were at. I was buying a prepaid debit card. I needed to buy this debit card to send to my girlfriend that lives in Louisiana so that she could come see me. So he's trying to hook up with Jessica, but he has a girlfriend that he's buying a debit card to come see him. Strike number two, buddy.
Mm-hmm.
He said that he then returned to Cortland just after 8 o'clock, and he had heard what happened to Jessica. And instead of being like a caring friend that he obviously was just texting her and being like, hey, are you okay? What's going on? Are you good? He immediately deletes her number and his their messages from his phone. When they asked why did you do that? He said, well, she wasn't around anymore. Strike number three, buddy.
Damn.
That's cold. Very cold. The FBI agent began trying to check out Quentin's alibi. They go to the dollar store that Quentin said he went to, talk to the manager. They view the surveillance camera, and sure enough, there was Quentin buying a debit card in the store at about 8 o'clock. The drive from the side of the car to the store was only 15 minutes, though, meaning he could have made the drive from the burn site to the store, but barely. It would have been very tight, but it could be done. They still did not have enough evidence to charge anyone, and soon rumors began circulating through the town. Jessica was known to hang out with a rougher crowd, and some kind of wondered, you know, did she maybe piss off the wrong people? Did she have a drug dealing gone bad? Like, they rumors were flying. And another name that kept getting brought up was Jessica's boyfriend. So his name was Travis Sanford. He was 9 years older than Jessica, and he had been arrested about a month before she was killed for burglary charges. They were known to have a kind of a tumultuous.
Wow.
I quit. I'm done.
You're speaking in cursive today.
I know. How do you say that? Tumultuous.
There you go.
Tumultuous relationship. She was a very gorgeous girl, and he was a very jealous guy. And so that often caused a lot of fights between them. I thought you were going to say something.
I almost did.
What are you going to say?
I know the feeling.
You want to fight?
Not that we fight, but...
Oh.
I've almost had to fight people for you.
That's a story.
Many times.
That's a story for another day. Okay.
Especially, well, not just because she's pretty, but she also has a little bit of mouth.
Not anymore.
Not anymore, but when you were younger, good Lord. Got me in a lot of trouble.
That's fun. It's never boring.
I was never boring, that's for sure.
I've calmed down in my old age.
We both have.
Listen, GGP gang, between researching murders at 2 a.m. and trying to convince ourselves that every creak in the house is definitely a ghost, we need energy. Not the jittery, heart-exploding kind. You know, the kind that makes you feel like you're about to fight a raccoon. Nope, we're talking about Dubby. The clean, crash-free energy that keeps us awake, alive, and able to tell you spooky stories without sounding like zombies. Whether you're editing recordings, chasing kids, or just trying to convince your friends that your house isn't haunted, Dubby's got your back. Go to dubby.gg.com, Use our promo code GGP, that's GGP for Guilty Ghostly Podcast, and snag your 10% off your order. So get yourself some Dubby, because the only thing that should be dragging is the ghost that we're talking about.
Okay, where was I? Oh yeah, he was jealous. There were rumors that he may have put out a hit on her for being unfaithful while he was in prison. So the detectives, they're like, well, let's go check him out. So they went, they told him what happened, and he was completely devastated. Like, they looked at all the leads, they looked at him in every way, shape, or form. They could not find anything showing that he hired a hit out on her. And he was genuinely completely devastated that Jessica was killed. So
wow.
He checks out. Now, 6 months have gone by and the case is starting to go cold. That's when they bring in Mr. Paul Rolette. He is an investigator with the U.S. District Attorney Office, and he started looking at the cell phone data from the case. He was able to use cell phone tower data and pinpoint the general area that the phone was and, like, what towers it was pinging off of, and they were basically able to follow Jessica with her movements. Mm-hmm. And then they started looking at the surveillance camera and seeing, does that ping match with where it's showing that she's at? And it did. So they had a pretty good...
like a timeline.
Timeline and map of where she was and where she went. They knew at about 6 o'clock she was in Batesville. They then decided to look at Quentin's phone. It also showed that he was in Batesville at the same time. So Jessica called Quentin at 5:30 while at the M&M store, and at 6, both phones are pinging off a tower in Batesville together. But if you remember, Quentin had said he only went to Batesville after 8 o'clock to get a debit card.
Mm-hmm.
They go find Quentin to talk to him again. This time when they find him, he's sitting in jail in Monroe, Louisiana for fraud charges. So Quentin agrees he's going to talk to the investigators. He waived his right to an attorney. He's like, yes, sir, I'm here to talk to you. I thought we cleared all this up. Like, what's going on? And he seemed pretty concerned. So they sit down with him and they say, hey, we need to talk about some things. And they begin to basically lay out all the evidence that they found with the phone towers. They begin to tell him that according to the cell phone data, it's showing that he was in Batesville with Jessica that night. Quentin denies it, says he didn't go there till after 8. There's no way. So then the detective's kind of like, well, then who had your cell phone? Because if you weren't there, somebody had your cell phone. And that's when Quentin said, I did go to Batesville at 6 o'clock with my buddy, Big Mike. He didn't say he was with her. He said, I did see Jessica in Batesville that night. We saw Jessica at Taco Bell. I gave her $10. Gave her some weed, but then I got back into the truck with Big Mike and we went back to Cortland to hang out with some friends, and then Big Mike dropped me off. Then he said he was at home until he left to go get the prepaid card. They even say, do you promise to God? And he's like, I promise on my mama. And they're like, okay. So what do? They go talk to Big Mike. They track him down. Big Mike says, there's no freaking way. I was in Tennessee at a Titans game that night. Me and my truck. There was no way he was in my truck that night. They looked it up. Sure enough, Big Mike was in Tennessee that night at a game. No way Quentin was with him that night.
Hmm.
And seeing Jessica at the Taco Bell.
Alibi just folded.
Lied again. Lie, lie, lie.
And put it on his mom.
On his mama's life. So they go back to Quentin. They lay it all out. They talk about his lies, how they basically have disproved everything that he's telling them. Quentin finally admits that, you know what? I was with Jessica that night. They had gone to Batesville together, and then they went back to his house to smoke some weed in his car behind his mama's house. Behind that shed.
Uh-huh.
The same place that he told detectives that he supposedly had sex with Jessica the week before she was murdered. He goes on to say that a little after 7, Jessica left. She just left. And the investigators tell him that the version of the story still isn't quite matching up to the evidence because the cell phone data shows they were together at least until 7:30 before Jessica's phone goes completely silent. Quentin becomes agitated. He jumps up. He starts going ballistic. So completely 180 from Mr. I want to help you. Let me answer your questions. I thought we got this cleared up. Now he's mad. Very agitated. 14 long months after not having any answers, investigators finally made an announcement. Quentin Tellis is indicted for the murder of Jessica Chambers.
Wow.
There was no murder weapon, no physical evidence putting Quentin in the car at the time of the murder, and lastly, Jessica's own words saying Eric or Derek in response to who did this to her, which we'll talk about that too. The town became split. Many believe that they have the right guy, others believing that they're just pinning this on a young black guy that has a rap sheet. Like, it was very split in half. So the trial begins. Finally, 3 years after her murder, the trial begins, and the prosecution's opening statement is very emotional and claims to have all the technological evidence against Quentin. They also knew that the Eric or Derek defense was going to be brought up, so they decided, let's get ahead of it. Let's just nip it in the bud right now. He says he knows that the names were thought to have been heard, but do not let that influence them until they hear all the evidence of the case. It was the defense's turn, and they, right off the bat, bring up the names being said. She also brings up the alleged cell phone records and how they are not as reliable as the prosecution is saying. She goes on to say that Eric is not on trial here today, and for this reason, we ask that you will find Quentin Tellis not guilty as a result. I really hope I put this in here and I didn't, like, delete it somewhere. If I did, I'll talk about it in a minute on why they also decided to go ahead and press charges. But I think I talk about it later on. It was really late when I was researching this, guys. Somebody was snoring next to me.
Sorry. Got to get my beauty rest.
You're crazy.
Crazy for you.
Oh, so smooth. All right. So they bring Keisha Myers, Jessica's best friend, first. They bring up the moment that happened 3 days before the murder. Jessica and Keisha were giving Quentin a ride somewhere, and Quentin was getting out of the car. Quentin went to give Jessica a hug, and Keisha recalls that Jessica was acting like almost scared or like she didn't want to hug him. Like she was just kind of pulling away, like, I don't want to do this. But Quentin continued to hug her and basically wouldn't let her go. So she kind of was like, that's kind of weird. She noticed some tension. Bringing further evidence that it was possible that Quentin was interested in sex with Jessica, even though she wasn't. The defense then begins their cross-examination, and they start with the morning that Jessica was killed on December 6th. They asked if there was any animosity between Jessica and Quentin that morning, and Keisha said no, it seemed like everything was normal, and so they put possible doubt in the situation. But, I mean, I've been there. I've had guy friends where they were interested in it and I wasn't. And you don't want to hurt their feelings. You want to be friends and kind of like let them down easy. And you just kind of ignore it and act like everything's fine. It's kind of like the, as a girl, as a woman, you just try to pacify it. Like you just try not to rock the boat. And so even though you're not comfortable with them, you just, okay, yeah, we'll hang out with them and act like everything's normal.
Yeah, I can see that side, but I've also been on the flip side of that coin. And it would have been easier for me had I been told or just completely rejected. Because sometimes those signals get crossed, especially in a young man's mind. And the chase itself is more fun than anything else.
Yeah.
For a guy.
Yeah.
So I can see, I guess I can see both sides of the
yeah. And you can see where it kind of built up to this, to where it could be. And I think that's what we'll get to it, the jury, what they struggled with, is it because it could be either one of those. It could have been she just wasn't interested, she was trying to pacify, or it could have been she was kind of like, hey, you know.
Mm-hmm. Just kind of flirtatious a yeah. little bit and maybe bringing some of that attention on herself. I yeah. hate to say that.
Yeah, guys, we're not victim blaming at all because she did not deserve and, you know, and even if she did, even if she wanted to kind of lead it on, that doesn't mean you get to freaking kill her.
No, and honestly, at that point, once you've gone to a certain level with this, it's time to stop.
Yeah.
But then there's those guys that don't know when to quit.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So I get it. Doesn't make it right.
No.
Doesn't make it right at all.
And she's not here to defend herself.
Right.
So.
So honestly, it's hard to say what
mm-hmm.
that whole situation entailed. Being a third party.
And that's exactly what the defense wanted. They wanted yeah. to kind of lead with that.
And I could see how that would create doubt in the jury and throughout the entire process.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy.
Yeah.
So they brought up the rougher crowd that Jessica was hanging out with. They mentioned that she dabbled in selling drugs. They tried to paint a picture of this troubled girl who probably pissed off the wrong people, and they went after her. After going back and forth, Cole Haley was brought to the stand. He was one of the first volunteers to arrive to the scene. When listening to them give their testimonies, you can hear the trauma. I only pulled his, but if you have time to go listen to the testimonies of these volunteer fire department and how bad it affected them, there's plenty of YouTube videos. This documentary was very good. They showed a lot of them. It's you can see how badly it affected them. Like, it is rough. And I actually have a video of you to watch his part of his testimony that he gave about finding Jessica. And I will play that clip now.
Who's this?
This is Cole. I think it was Haley. He was one of the first responders that showed up.
Mr. Haley. On December the 6th of 2014, about 8:12 p.m., you responded to a car fire.
Yes, sir. When I arrived, I pulled on up to where the car was on fire.
Did you know Jessica Chambers?
I knew her. We weren't, you know, friends or anything, but I knew her.
When you first arrived on the scene, did you recognize this person?
No, sir, I did not.
What was this person wearing?
When I seen her, she had nothing on but her panties. I got out and I got a blanket, and she had her arms out, was coming towards me, saying, help me, help me, help me.
Nicole, I want you to describe for this jury, what did she look like? What was the condition of Jessica Chambers?
Her hair was fried out, like she's stuck in the light socket. And she had black all over her face. Her body was severely burned. And I wrapped a blanket around her to conceal her. She reached out for my hand. I held on to her hand. Her mouth, inside her mouth, was just charred black. And when I asked her name, she said, Jessica Chambers. And she was not recognizable to me. I know what Jessica Chambers looked like. Knowing this is Cortland, I said, this is Jessica Chambers, not Chambers.
In all your years of being a firefighter, have you ever seen anything like this?
No, sir. I hope I never see anything like it again.
You can see how much it affected them.
Oh, my God.
Heart-wrenching.
Oh, man, that is so sad. His reaction is, I mean, you can tell that that's genuine, just sadness.
Yeah, and you can tell he goes right back to that night every time he retells it.
Yeah.
Once the prosecution was done, the defense hands him a sworn statement and asks him to read what he said that Jessica's dying declaration was. He begins to read it off and says that she said that someone set her on fire. He asked who set her on fire. She then said what sounded like Eric. While he was on the stand, he said that he couldn't hardly make out what she was saying, and even mentions when she was trying to say her name, she said Jessica Chambers rather than Chambers. This sworn statement says that he heard her say Eric, which contradicts what he was saying on the stand. He would say that, you know, he gave the statement, he was in a daze from the trauma of seeing another human being in that state, but the defense says even in Jessica's condition, there would be no way to mistake that Jessica said as being Quentin or Tellis. Prosecution continued to everyone who responded to the scene on the stand to give a better understanding of the complete chaos, the sound of the trucks, Jessica being so badly injured that it would be next to impossible to fully understand what she was saying.
Yeah, and that's another thing. I mean, like you said, her nostrils, her throat, all of that stuff got burnt. And the more she talked, I'm sure the more damage
it was causing.
It caused to her.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and very well could have altered the way she was speaking the more she spoke.
Yes.
So Derek could have just been a noise that she was making.
I found a theory that I think this is what the theory is. And yeah. We'll talk about it in a little bit. Even bringing up the question, if she was coherent enough to know what she was saying, like, did she even know what she was saying? Did she know what was going on?
Yeah, that's another question. I mean, because in that state of panic and shock and who knows what she was saying?
Yeah. Who knows if she knew what she was saying?
Yeah, I mean, she could have just been trying to scream even.
Yep. Witness after witness, they all testified the same thing. When they asked Jessica who did this, she choked out a sound that sounds similar to Eric. They then brought Jerry King onto the stand, which is the guy that found the keys. We're going to dive a little bit deeper into that. So Jerry King tells the jury that he lives close to the crime scene on Heron Road. A few days after Jessica's murder, he was walking his baby in the stroller down the road, sees a set of keys with a pink lanyard on it, and he told him where he found them in the ditch. Where he found them, it would have been on the route to go back to Quentin's house from the burn site. King gives the keys to his daughter to play with on the way back to the house. Supposedly, once he gets back to the house, he sees the tag on it. It says Ben's Body Shop. He realizes, ah, shit, this is connected to Jessica Chambers. He calls the police. They have him take the keys back to where he found them. They put the keys back in the estimated spot where they found them and took the pictures and then sent those off for DNA testing. During the trial, they bring a forensic DNA specialist to the stand. She says that DNA from more than one person were found on the keychain and lanyard. Most of the DNA was female's DNA, thought to possibly be Jessica's. They also found some DNA from some male DNA. So they actually have to run a whole separate test to narrow down the male DNA. So they did one saying, okay, this one's female, this one's male. So now they have to do a whole nother test to say who does it belong to or what it is. They ended up finding out that there were four different sources of male DNA. They asked if Quentin's DNA was found on the keys, and she said his DNA could not be excluded as a contributor to the mixture of male DNA they found. So it couldn't rule him out, but it also could not positively identify him. They then bring Paul Rolette to go over the cell phone data. So this is the big cell phone guru guy. He says that Jessica's phone data shows. Yeah, this is where I talked about it. Okay, this is the good part. Let me get comfy. Okay, I knew I had it in here. I was scared. Gotta have faith in myself. Okay, so they bring Paul Rolette to go over the cell phone data. He says that Jessica's phone data shows that she arrived at the scene of the murder at 7:30. There was a missing gap of time between 6:30 to 7:30, though. Looking at the cell phone pings, it places Jessica at three different locations. Starting at the M&M store, Quentin Tellis's house, and then the area behind Quentin's house where they said they had, where Quentin had said they had sex the week before, and then supposedly went to go smoke weed the night of her murder. Quentin's phone lines up perfectly with hitting the same towers at the same time as Jessica's. From 6:49 to 7:26, there was no activity on either phone. They bring up the surveillance video at the M&M store since Quentin lived right across the street from it. You can see Jessica's car pull out at about 7:25 going south, which is towards Heron Road. And mind you, they found the burning car at 8. At 7:26, the car is moving. Jessica's phone starts pinging off the towers near the murder scene. So the car leaves his house, goes straight to the murder scene. No calls, no texts are made from her phone, and 15 minutes later, Jessica and her car are found set on fire. If that's not shady enough, at 7:50, you can see a vehicle pull into Quentin's shed. So where the surveillance camera is, you can actually see a vehicle go into Quentin's shed at 7:50. It's there for just over a minute. It was like a minute and 10 seconds or a minute and 15 seconds. The vehicle then leaves and turns going south towards Heron Road. Earlier on in the investigation, Quentin had showed investigators a 5-gallon gas can in the shed. The theory is that Quentin returned back to the shed and grabbed the gas tank and went back to Heron Road, covered the car and Jessica in the gas, and lit them on fire. He then goes to the dollar store to purchase the card to create an alibi. He also deletes all of Jessica's phone calls, text messages, and contact info from his phone. The defense counters that since Cortland is such a rural area, there aren't as many cell towers, making the cell phone pings less accurate. And it's not as precise as prosecution is saying. So that is true. And again, that kind of goes back to the confusing the jury, mm-hmm. because it is such a rural area. There's not very many towers to where if there are a lot of towers, you have a better streamline of it pinging off of each tower. Mm-hmm. Well, there's not that many there. So it's pinging off of this one. And then, you know, it's just not as accurate. It really isn't as accurate. And that was the defense's point. Like, you're saying that, but how accurate is it? Because there's not a whole lot of towers. And so they kind of went back and forth on that for a while. She also says that on the video, you cannot see the actual driver of the car, and it is just a theory that Quentin is driving the car. So what's the motive? For 4 consecutive days, Quentin was trying to get Jessica to have sex with him, and she would repeatedly reject him. The prosecution believes that something happened that night when they were at Quentin's house. He ended up rendering Jessica unconscious one way or another. He might have thought he killed her or seriously injured her and needed to get rid of the evidence. Shortly after 8 o'clock, Quentin sent Jessica a text that said something like, "Hey, bae, I can't see you tonight. My girlfriend's coming up. Sweet dreams." But he was just with her 15 minutes before that. Little weird. And again, it's establishing that alibi. I can't mm-hmm. see you. You were just with her.
Mm-hmm.
This was after they were together just 15 minutes prior, and the defense closes with the name Eric again. That Jessica said Eric was the one who did it, giving reasonable doubt. After 6 days of testimony, the jury would start their deliberations. One day later, the jury says they've reached a verdict. So I'm fixing to blow your mind. This is fixing to get wild. Have you ever watched a court proceedings where the judge actually goes through in detail how the jurors are supposed to come up with a verdict? It's supposed to be unanimous and like all the rules and regulations to do it.
No. I've never seen that.
Okay. I wish I would have included it. I cut it out. You'll have to go watch it. They literally tell you step by step. Everybody has to agree. It has to be unanimous. Like, he goes through all the rules and regulations of the jurors to reach a verdict. So these jurors come back with their verdict.
I understand that this has been a very emotional time for families and loved ones in this case. I understand all that very perfectly. This court has a heart like any other person. And I understand both sides, both families that are involved and friends. I understand all of that. Same time, I'm going to ask you and remind you to dignify these court proceedings accordingly. All right, if you bring the jury in, please. I've been told that the jury's reached a verdict. Is that correct? Did you all select a foreman? All right, sir. Let's see. Mr. Lampkin, is that correct?
That is correct.
All right. I don't need to know what your verdict was, but I just need to know, did all 12 jurors agree on that verdict?
Yes, sir, we did.
All right. Would you hand the verdict, please, to the court, to the clerk? Excuse me.
We all didn't agree on it.
Sir?
You said we all agreed on that verdict. We didn't.
All 12. The verdict has to be unanimous. So all 12 did not agree on the verdict? Is that what you're telling me, sir?
Yeah, I didn't agree he was
there. All right. I'd ask you to step back into the jury room, please. Pass the verdict, please, to the clerk that you have in your hand.
Chaos erupted. Complete chaos.
That's insane.
Yeah.
So, like, they went in there and said that they were ready to go, but then one guy was like, oh, no.
Yeah. No, not everybody agreed on that. And it wasn't just the one guy that didn't agree.
Really? So there were people just trying to railroad that verdict then, huh?
I guess there was confusion on what unanimous meant. I don't know if they didn't know what that meant. I don't know if, like you said, they were just kind of railroading it, saying, I want to be done with this. So the judge sends the jury back until they can all reach a verdict. He said, you all have to agree. He sends them back. After about 30 minutes, they say, we've reached a verdict. So they come back out. So when they come back out, the judge clarifies again. You all agreed. The foreman says, yes, sir. The clerk then reads the following out to the court. We, the jury, find the defendant, Quentin Verdell Tellis, not guilty.
Are you fucking kidding me?
Of capital murder.
I apologize for the outburst, but holy shit, really?
So, get ready. The prosecution says, I didn't know they could do this. I want a poll. I want to know which each jury member voted. I didn't know they could do that, but I guess they can.
Oh, I didn't know that either.
So he says, I want a poll. So the judge says, okay. So he begins, he's going to start asking the jury one by one, asking if they agreed with the verdict. The first juror is asked, I can't remember her name, but he said, you know, did you vote as not guilty? And she says, I voted guilty. They did not agree. Again. Vote was not unanimous. So again, chaos erupts in the courtroom. They're like, what is going on? For it to happen once is crazy, but to happen twice, like, this never happens. What is going on?
Yeah, no kidding.
So they send the jury back. He said, this is your last chance. It has to be unanimous. Sends them back in. Within an hour, the jury comes back out. It's a hung jury. They cannot agree.
Of course it is.
They can't make a decision. So the case ends in a mistrial. About a year later, after the first trial, the second trial begins on September 24th, 2018. Most of the same witnesses are brought back. They kind of use the same line of defense, but this time they also add Dr. William Hickerson, who was a world-renowned burn specialist where Jessica was taken to be treated for her injuries. They discuss the severity of her injuries, how bad her torso was burned, and it basically acted as a leather cast around her body. Mm-hmm. So she could no longer expand or inhale any air, making talking basically impossible. They showed the autopsy photos during the trial, and which I will say, her mother was there for this, so she's happened to look at those photos. She basically kept her head down the entire time, and she even said in the documentary, I couldn't put Jessica's face with those photos. I would not have been able to make it through it. She said, I kept my head down. I didn't look at it. And if I did look at it, then I just could not associate that with Jessica.
Yeah. And I watch a lot of, like, not necessarily true crime like you do, but a lot of the beginning stages of that.
Mm-hmm.
The police and stuff are there, and they're doing the investigations on it. some more like cops, I guess, to an extent. And you like to watch the aftermath of it mm-hmm. more. And I was watching one today, and these rival gang members or whatever had gotten into a little tussle or whatever, and a couple of kids got shot. So the police were keeping the family from seeing them in that position because they didn't want that to be the last thing on those people's minds.
They do that a lot. Yeah.
So, I mean, I can totally understand not wanting to see my loved one in that condition.
Yep.
For the very last time.
100%. 100%. They showed the autopsy photos during the trial and showed marks on Jessica's chest that looked to be bruising that could not be attributed to the fire. This also brought more credence to the sexual assault theory. After 5 days of testimony, one day of deliberation, the jury once again cannot reach a verdict. It's another mistrial. The jury was split right in half. Six said guilty, six said not guilty. The prosecution then tries to decide if they're going to move forward with another trial because they've already done this twice. And I'll explain more here in a minute. And I guess I'll talk about it now because we're fixing to move on to something else. One of the theories is instead of saying Derek or Eric, she could have been out of it and thought wreck and was trying to say wreck because they were asking who did this. Well, if she's kind of out of it and has no idea what happened, she just woke up on fire in her car, she could have been thinking wreck.
Mm-hmm.
And if you remember, I said 93% of her body was burned except for the bottoms of her feet and a small of her back. They believe she was unconscious in the vehicle and he threw the accelerant on her. And that's why the small of her back and the bottom of her feet were not burned, because everything else is doused in that accelerant.
Interesting.
Which I could see the wreck theory. Her being completely out of it, not knowing what's happened. She'd been knocked out or lost consciousness for whatever reason, whether he strangled her or head trauma, I don't know.
Yeah.
She wakes up in her car and it's on fire. She could have been saying wreck
mm-hmm.
instead of Eric.
Mm-hmm.
So, just interesting. Okay. So, it's another mistrial. Second mistrial. So, they're trying to decide, what are we going to do? We got to have more evidence. We've got to figure something else out to convince this jury that he did it. The prosecution then tries to decide if they're going to move forward with another trial. While all that's going on, the state of Louisiana asked to extradite Quentin back because he is the suspect of another murder of a young woman.
Wow.
So when he was in Monroe, Louisiana for those fraud charges, they just hadn't charged him with the murder of a woman yet. They were building that case.
Holy crap.
So while this trial's going on, Louisiana and Mississippi basically made a deal. They said, you can extradite him back to try him for Jessica's murder. That will give us time to build our case against this other one. And once you're done with them, we can do what we need to do.
Mm-hmm.
So now they have the second mistrial. So Louisiana's like, let us have a shot at it.
Mm-hmm.
Give them to us. So they extradite him back to Louisiana. So this is what happened in Louisiana. Just 8 months after Jessica's murder, and before Quentin was on trial, another murder takes place in Monroe, Louisiana. And an apartment manager gets a call about a strange smell coming from one of the apartments. He goes into the apartment, and it's obvious there was a struggle had taken place. He enters the bedroom, and there's the body of a young woman. Her body is in advanced state decomp, and she had been repeatedly stabbed many times. The police are called. The manager identifies the victim as Ming Chen Chow. Her friends called her Mandy, like from the United States. She was an exchange student that had been in the United States for a couple of years. They believe that she had been dead for about 10 days before she was discovered. She was stabbed 30 times.
Holy shit.
They find a Walmart receipt from July 28th, the day before they believe she was murdered. So they go to Walmart and get surveillance video. On it, they see Mandy, or Ming Chen, buying something from the pharmacy, and then she gets into a black Chevy Impala with someone inside of it. They found out that Mandy had gotten a prescription for some painkillers, and when she got into that car, there was a young African-American man waiting in the car, and when she gets in, she hands him the painkillers. Like, they can see that on video. They then begin to look at her financial records and discover that someone's been taking money out of her account after she had been killed using her debit card.
Wow.
They pull the video from the ATM that was used, and it's the same man they seen in the Walmart parking lot. They run the license plate from the Impala, and it comes back to belonging to Quentin Tellis.
I'll be damned.
Quentin had moved to Monroe, Louisiana, supposedly to be closer to his fiance now. That girlfriend he was buying the debit card, it's his fiance now. And 8 months later, he's like, I need to get the hell out of Dodge, is what I think. This was the same neighborhood as Mandy, and the police immediately arrest Quentin for unauthorized use of a debit card until they can build a better case for the murder. They didn't have any physical evidence showing that Quentin had been in the apartment. But someone calls Crime Stoppers, and they have not released any of the bank stuff out to the public. They have not released any information about somebody stealing her money after she had passed away, so nobody knew that. Someone had called Crime Stoppers and claimed that he had a friend that had admitted to killing Ming, and he tortured her until she gave him her credit card or her debit card PIN, and then he killed her, took the debit card, and was getting money. This gives the police the evidence they need to charge Quentin with the murder, because the friend said, it's Quentin Tellis that told me this.
Mm-hmm.
The prosecutors decide to delay the trial until after the Jessica Chambers case. In June 2019, after the two mistrials, Quentin is then taken back to Louisiana, and he pleads not guilty. So, that's where the trial or the documentary ends.
Mm-hmm.
So I started doing Google search to like, is there any update on this? Where is it at? Get ready for this. The latest update that I found was from December 2nd of 2025. The trial for Mandy is delayed due to a key witness dying in a car wreck just days before he was set to testify. That witness was Paul Rolette, the expert witness in the Jessica Chambers case that linked the cell phone data showing Quentin to be with Jessica the night of his murder. They were going to use him in the Mandy case as well, and he was traveling from Mississippi to Louisiana for the trial and was killed in a car wreck.
No shit.
So as of right now, Mandy's trial is on hold until they're either able to find another expert witness that can either pick up where he left off or basically start over and rebuild it, or do they take the case on without having that expert witness. And so it's on hold right now.
That's crazy. Oh my God.
I told you this one was wild.
This is an insane case. And it started in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
All of this crap.
Mm-hmm.
And this dude's just...
Yeah. He's sent in prison at least, or jail, waiting trial. But yeah. And they still have not been able to convict him for Jessica's murder because it keeps ended up in a hung jury.
I don't understand that. Like, all the evidence points that he did it.
Yeah.
I mean, even if you could argue the fact that there wasn't enough towers to really pinpoint your location, his story didn't line up with where he was.
He lied and lied and lied again. And I think with him saying we had sex the week prior, I think he's giving a little bit of proof, like a truth. I think he was giving, starting with little truth crumbs, just enough, because they do that all the time. It starts with a truth somewhere in the lie. I think he tried to have sex with her that night. She denied it. He hurt her, thought he killed her, went to burn the evidence, not realizing she was still alive.
Yeah, that makes sense. To me, that seems like the only plausible idea.
Yeah.
That's how I see it too.
And even if it maybe there's more doubt with it with just that case, but then you add Ming Chen or Mandy, mm-hmm. Mandy's case to it, where he's involved again.
Mm-hmm. Now it shows a pattern.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, that's insane. I wonder how many actual cases end up like this.
Yeah. Just in limbo and...
Yeah. I mean, that's just insane. And now these people are here with absolutely zero justice.
Her mother, it may have been her mother and her father, both said, I would have much rather them come back and say guilty or even not guilty than a hung jury. Because then it's final. It's done.
Yeah.
They're, you know, whatever, they can move on. But it's in limbo. There's nothing they can do.
Mm-hmm.
It's just stuck in limbo.
That's insane.
Yep. So it's a long one.
It's been a really long one.
But I couldn't leave out. There was so much information and so much to the story.
Yeah, so stick around for part two.
No, that was it. That was it. We're not doing part two. That was it. And I didn't want to split it up. I hate when they split it up into two parts and it just... I think it'll be better as one long one.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, there's so much information in this one.
Yeah.
And even with all the research you did, I still don't think you covered it all.
Probably not, no. No.
I mean, just what I heard here, there's no way that you could have covered every little detail on that. And I mean, that's just, there's so much.
Yeah.
So many layers to this.
Yep. Yeah. An onion has layers.
Yeah. And onions sometimes stink. Just like that guy's alibi.
That was smooth. Yeah. That was real smooth.
Yeah, it was.
Yep. All right. Well, I guess that's it this week. I made you sit here long enough. Our butts hurt. We got to get better chairs, guys. We were just talking about that. I want one of those big, like, comfy TikTok chairs.
I'm just going to bring in my computer chair. That's more comfortable than this is.
Yeah.
I just wish it rocked.
Yeah. No, because then it'd creak.
That's true.
Yeah.
So stay tuned for next week when we peel back the layers of another onion.
I can't with you. Next week, it's not going to be nearly as dark. I think it's going to be more of a dark history.
Oh, okay. Well, that'll be a good palate cleanser.
Good palate cleanser. Exactly.
This one here was pretty rough.
It was hard. So make sure to take care of yourselves.
Yep.
Get some, what's it called? Dopamine. Dopamine hits.
Is that
hits?
What the kids are calling it these days?
Yeah. Dopamine hits. And stay curious.
Yeah.
Stay spooky.
Don't stay guilty.
Don't look at that. You're supposed to look at that.
I was looking at my mic.
Oh, I couldn't tell you're cross-eyed.
So I was real close to it.
That's what I'd say too. Bye, guys.
Bye, y'all.